This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt and Warwick Long on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
I'm just really disappointed that it is withdrawn so soon, and I think it's going to be really tough for a lot of women out there, where we're seeing the collision of all of these different policy changes disproportionately impacting women, particularly women in higher education, on top of it, who are also looking down the barrel of pay cuts and losing casual staff and workloads increasing, and then childcare gets taken away. I've got one in childcare and two in school at the moment. I've had to increase my daughter's childcare to full time, despite the fact I only work 3 days a week, because my workload has increased so much because of the lack of casual. And now we now have to take a pay cut. So I just don't know how I'm going to meet those fees.
So today on The Conversation Hour, we are asking, could and should childcare be free permanently? Is it possible, and how would it change the lives of Victorian families and individuals? Warwick Long, I don't know about you, but how often have you heard a friend or a colleague at work say, I work simply to pay childcare and I wonder if it's worth it. But if I'm not here, I feel like I can't keep a foot in the door and I might lose my job. Maybe this is a way to stop those comments.
Sadly, it's almost a rite of passage when you're a new parent, isn't it? It's the one conversation you have constantly with all your friends, talking about how expensive childcare is. Because even though you'd heard that, you never really realise until you're paying it. And just trying to make the juggle of all the life around that. Imagine if childcare was free. And I also wonder what that would do to the role of grandparents, who have often been lent on by those lucky enough to live close to grandparents, though. But it's almost like another job for some grandparents looking after children, trying to help their actual child get ahead in life by looking after the grandkids constantly because of the cost and the burden of childcare. So what would happen if childcare was free all the time? What would it do to our society?
I feel like we would implode in some way, because it feels impossible. It sounds like just one of those crazy questions that you would throw out there. It is being done in the Netherlands. I mean, they are always at the forefront and testing new things and making life just feel and seem a little bit simpler. But today we're going to speak to a range of experts about whether or not they think it's even possible. Is it possible economically? Like, could Victoria be, you know, would we be okay if we made childcare free? And then personally, you know, what would it do to not just women, but to working families and individuals? How would it change people's lives? So is it even vaguely possible? I don't know if we'll get to the bottom of it this hour, though, Woz.
Exactly. But what if childcare was free all the time? What would it take? Does it take much more taxes from us? Because when we speak about other countries, we've got to remember how much they pay there. But then it's also, how would it work in our society? What should we be thinking of?
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour
with Rochelle Hunt and Warwick Long.
What if childcare was free? What would it take? How would it work? And is that the society you want to live in? This person says, I would only agree to free childcare if childcare was government run. I would not want taxpayer money going towards making private companies super wealthy. And another text here saying, childcare should never be free. Someone has to pay.
Well, that's the difference there between public and private as well. That's a huge part of this conversation. What do you think? 1-300-222-774. Associate Professor Leah Rupner, she's a Professor of Sociology and also the co-director of the Policy Lab at the University of Melbourne. Leah, you are also hugely involved in our Australia Talk survey, which gave us a snapshot of how we think about those big key issues in Australia and what makes up a household dynamic. Would the world come to an end as we knew it if childcare was free?
Absolutely not. We have free childcare right now, and I don't think the world has ended. We actually got free childcare because the world ended. So it's totally feasible.
And in terms of doing it long term, though, there's a difference between a stimulus when a government's happily spending money, and then when you have a government which is saying it needs to get us back in black. They even put it on a mug before all of this. Is it the difference in the psychology of those running the country, or does there literally need to be thought to what this would cost and what the benefit would be?
Okay, so I think it's important at this point to point out that even though Australia has done an incredible job leaders perhaps in the world on the response to the first wave of COVID-19. We are in no way out of the woods. I was on a panel this morning with experts from across the University of Melbourne, and one of the most startling things that I saw from this panel came from Jeff Groland, who's a leading economist, and he showed the decline in hours worked in Australia at this moment in time. And what you can see is compared to the 1980 and 1990 recession, what we are having now is double the rate in decline in employment. It's important to point out that this recession, they're calling it a she-cession, right? That it's knocking out women's employment, what jobs that women stereotypically enter. I'm not talking about the nursing. I'm not talking about the childcare workers, but they're getting knocked out. So this idea that we're done with this is so far from the truth. We're going to hit a recession. And what do we need to make sure that people can work, people can enter the labor market, people can reskill, especially if women are knocked out at higher rates than men? And I am going to tell you that if they do not have someone to care for their children, reliable, safe, affordable childcare, women cannot work. The woman who, this is the last thing I say, I promise. The woman who came, you could hear at the beginning of the session, kind of that tension in the woman's voice talking about, you're going to take the childcare away. And it sounded like she was about to break into tears, right? I think this is how a lot of women are feeling right now. The kids have come home. The jobs are either disappearing or are also home. And the care burden, the care crisis is just too big to shoulder alone. And if we cannot do it, who can we rely on to help? And is the government, does the government have a role? I think it's a huge mistake to take away the child care credit. I think it's coming too soon. It's going to lead to higher rates of unemployment. I think it's a terrible policy decision at this point in time.
But how on earth do we pay for it? I mean, as was said, this is a stimulus package. This is something short term. And we knew at the time that when it was going to get taken away, it was going to be stressful. It was going to be controversial. And people would say, how on earth can you give me something this important and then take it away from me? But we knew it was coming. So, I mean, how could Victoria survive economically? How could we make childcare free?
Well, I think there's a question of, can you survive with having women knocked out of employment, right? Like, can you survive with some percentage of your population just not being able to step in, not because they aren't capable, competent, desiring, skilled, but they can't figure out where to, they can't afford to put their kids anywhere. There's two things I want to say to you about this. The Grattan Institute ran a report that showed actually, you know, the way in which the tax structure existed prior to this COVID epidemic, that it became unaffordable. This is what you all were talking about at the beginning, right? Actually, the tax structure doesn't make sense to work full time because you end up paying more money for childcare once you reach a certain income threshold. Does that make sense? Is that how we want to make decisions? But I will say to you that this is a moment in which governments are throwing out lifelines, right? They are picking which industries are winners and which industries are losers. I will say to you, if we can afford to say you can have $50,000 to remodel your bathroom, why can we not afford to say you can have $50,000 to make sure your child has high quality care, that they are there in a safe environment, and that you as a parent, right? Because we always think about this as a woman's issue, but you as a parent, the family, you can either use that money to reinvest into the economy, right? If people are getting, if families are getting $3,000 back or $4,000 back per month from childcare, that money's going to go right back in to stimulate the economy, right? People can now afford to buy houses. People can have additional kind of nest eggs to do things to that will lubricate the economy. So I don't want to think about this as like just a withdrawal. If families have that money, they put it into the economy. If women step into employment at higher rates, you have higher productivity, you have taxes coming from there. Again, you have stimulating the economy. And I think if we think about this as being a unique recession that hit women hard, what do we need to do to support them in the recovery? And if we can give people $50,000 for construction of a bathroom, you know, or remodeling their house, and we can throw lifelines to construction, why are we not throwing equivalent lifelines to either female-dominated industries or childcare?
The renovation grant system is going to become the standard example everybody uses for what could be better government policy, I feel, out of this this stimulus package. Peter's in Mornington. Welcome to the Conversation Hour.
I just the use of the term free childcare is not correct. It's taxpayer funded, and it has to be funded and accurately and unemotionally, because, you know, you talk about money being spent in the construction sector. Well, that's to get the country out of recession. Parents should be, I mean, I've got kids, and my wife and I brought those kids up ourselves. We never looked to get anybody to look after our children. We accepted full responsibility when we had them. And we knew, you know, one of us was going to have to stay at home and be aware of that. And, you know, I think that it's unfair to place the burden upon the community for people who make decisions to have their families and not be fully responsible for them and accept the responsibility of providing them with the utmost care. You will never...
Hey, Peter, I'm just interested in that point you made, though, earlier about pumping money into construction gets the country out of recession, but pumping money into childcare wouldn't be having the same effect. Why do you see that difference there?
Because it employs people that actually generate, you know, they buy materials, they spend materials, they... It spreads
wider. Doesn't childcare do it in a different way, though? It's still buying materials for the care of children, and there's food and things like that attached to centres?
Well, perhaps so, but I still feel that, you know, pumping it into the construction industry or any other industry is actually generating employment for somebody to provide for their family or for their other partner to be able to stay at home and provide for their family.
That's an interesting point that you've said just there, though, Peter, and not that we want to shoot everything down that you say, but what if you don't have a partner? What if you're a single parent?
Well, I think there should be exemptions for that. I think that if there's an exemption for somebody who's single who doesn't have a partner, well, perhaps there should be some sort of way of funding that. But I don't think it should be broadly spread, you know, willy-nilly, just give somebody $3,000 a month for somebody whose responsibility is to look after their children. Ultimately, you're the person that brought this child into this world. Mm. You should be responsible for taking the utmost care for them. You'll care for your child much better than any other person in a childcare centre.
Good on you, Peter. Great to hear from you as well. This text is from Elizabeth in Dalesford, and I think she sort of agrees along with the lines that you're saying there. G'day, Warwick and Rochelle. A definite no from me to a fully government-sponsored childcare. I'm sick to death of paying for everybody else's everything. Why should the rest of us pay for life choices of others? It couldn't be fairer in any other circumstances than user pays. I'm happy to pay my own way in every walk of life. Thank you. That's from Elizabeth in Dalesford.
Loretta has sent a text along a different line, though, saying it's not just about babysitting and allowing parents to work. It's also about early learning for little ones. Imagine if every child in Australia had access to early learning experiences regardless of their income. Early intervention could make an enormous difference, says Loretta on the text there. Hey, Leah, I want to come back to you as well as part of this conversation. Peter was raising the idea of, you know, people should be home to look after their own kids, and they have different experiences that way. Is that where one of the arguments against free childcare is, given the population already of the planet is so big, and effectively allowing free childcare is promoting population growth beyond maybe what our planet could take?
This is where the Australia Talks data is really valuable, and some of the conversations Rochelle and I have had in the past. What's interesting from that is that today, Australian families, Australian young people are feeling just the intense economic pressure, right? Having a hard time buying a house, having a hard time making enough money to have a standard of living that allows them, you know, flexibility. And the result of that is that really that two parents now have to work, that the economic costs of living are so high that it is very, very hard to live on one salary in the way in which we did in the past. And this is a really important distinction, because you see young people are delaying fertility, they're having fewer babies, they're having them at later later ages. They're delaying first home purchases. They're delaying marriages. And this is an important component because what we think about our lives, you know, in the 1970s or in the 60s or how we organize our lives then, the reality of economic pressures today are totally different. So I think we have to remember that. The second thing is it's interesting to me that childcare is often this one thing where we say, hey, that's just like parents' responsibility, right? Like you bring the kids into the world, you need to make sure that you're responsible for them. But there's a million other things that we pay for. We have public education, right? We think it's really, really important to have an educated public to a certain standard, and that transcends through college education. So we pay for each other in all sorts of ways, healthcare, roads, education. And for some reason, this childcare that's, you know, this really, really integral period of time, both for mother's mental health, for kicking mothers out of employment, right? This is the moment where you see this real big transition where mothers exit, for children's health and well-being. No one is saying that parents don't do a good job. No one are saying that parents aren't responsible for their kids. But if we have childcare centers, and we know from all this literature that kids who enter high-quality childcare centers, that the gap, the educational gap between the haves and the have-nots closes. So why do we see this still as being a fully individual responsibility when there are a million things that we say, this makes a better society, I want to share.
This text, I found that after I had my first child, my teacher's wage would simply just pay for childcare. So I stayed at home. I now have the benefit of 5 well-adjusted, intelligent children. It cost me the ability to progress in my employment, but I did a uni degree online while the kids were small, and we're all benefiting from it now. We went without the annual overseas holidays as well as the flash car. Pam's called from Frankston. Pam, welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Oh, hi, thank you for taking the call. I just wanted to bring up the point that Peter made before. It's really not feasible in today's society for women to always stay at home, not to mention the fact that we actually do want to work and we do want to pursue our own careers. But the fact of free childcare or fully government-subsidised childcare, it's political will and ideology that prevents it. No one seems to have a problem with billions of dollars going to subsidise our fossil fuel industries every year. If the political will was there and the government supported it, we could fully fund childcare for everyone who needs it.
Why don't you think that happens, Pam?
Why do you think what happens? That people have archaic sexist attitudes to women in the workforce? Or you mean the actual funding?
Well, no, I think you've made the point,
Pam. You've answered it perfectly. Oh, it's good to hear from you. Erin's also called in, and Erin's worked within the early learning sector as an educator for over 20 years. But Erin...
Hello?
Hi, Erin. So you've been in this sector for 20 years and have just recently left. What's the reason for that?
We've continually been undervalued. So 20 years I've been campaigning for, at the start, better ratios, better pay and just professional recognition. Someone touched on before early intervention, which is, I think, one of the really important aspects of early childhood. Many parents come to us and don't have experience with children, so we get in touch with services that they need, which prepare them for school and, you know, a solid educational journey.
And with your experience in coming through this working in the sector and then coming out the other end, what's wrong with childcare at the moment?
Many employers, the disrespect from the government, I think, can't help but trickle down to, say, private employers, parents that are using the service, and just the general lack of respect that we've been treated with over many, many years.
And Erin, do you think the conversation around whether or not childcare should be funded should be made technically free? I know if maybe free is not the right word, but do you think it should be more accessible for families? Is all the families that you've dealt with over the years that are either struggling to pay or struggling to decide whether or not it's worth for them to put their kids into childcare, would something like this make a big difference?
Definitely, definitely would. Someone touched on like the mental health of mothers when they first have babies. It's really important to be able to have that access to the help that you need, and childcare is part of that. Definitely.
Erin, do you have any regrets leaving the industry?
Just that I feel like I should be fighting for it still, but after 20 years you kind of get a bit tired.
Yeah. It's the passion behind the industry as well
that always gets me. I mean, I still have incredibly fond memories of the women that looked after, and the guys as well. There was a couple of incredible men at my childcare centre.
Yeah.
But in those moments when you have to hand over your child to someone, it's daunting, it's frightening, it gives you back a little bit of identity. It's all of those things. So you do an incredible job. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank
you, Associate Professor Elizabeth Hill also joins us. She's from the University of Sydney and is the co-convener of the Australian Work and Family Policy Roundtable. Elizabeth, you've been listening to all of this. I guess my first question to you is, should childcare be free to all?
Well, it certainly should be very affordable and accessible to all families with young children. There's no doubt about that. If you look at the economic analysis, all the scientific analysis and the social analysis, we know that the provision of extremely affordable ECEC is essential. So the economic analysis is uncontested that it supports parents' ability to work and to participate in the labour force, and this is therefore ECEC is a productivity and growth measure. Really critical, particularly at the moment. You know, we've had a really changing shape to our labour force. We've got increased numbers of well-educated women. One of the great successes of the last couple of decades has been the rate of the improvements in education for women. But at the moment, they're not able to work at a level commensurate with their skill or the number of hours that they often require because of the high cost and lack of accessibility to high quality ECEC. So from an economic point of view, early childhood education and care that is accessible to all, not just some, is an essential piece of economic infrastructure, but it's also an essential piece of social infrastructure. So the scientific evidence on the benefits of early childhood education and care for young children are also uncontested. They promote the education, the well-being and the life chances of children. And this is particularly, as has a particularly strong impact on children from disadvantaged households, and in the current context of economic crisis and ongoing recession, we've got an additional cohort of children who are in households that are experiencing economic distress and who will stand to benefit the most from accessible, high-quality early childhood education and care. And the impact of that investment plays out over the entire life course of these children. It leaves them better prepared for entry into school, and also we see in some of the research better employment outcomes. And
when we talk economics, sorry, Professor, Associate Professor Hill, when we talk economics, do you have an idea, do we know what it would cost for Australia to have free childcare sort of on a per year basis?
Yeah, I mean, this issue of free, I mean, it's been discussed previously. Someone is paying, and I guess what we're talking about is a publicly funded universal early childhood education and care system. That's what we're talking about. We've got significant investment already by the federal government, more than $8 billion a year in the Commonwealth subsidy to the provision. But that provision is highly constrained. So there's a means test. And there's also an activity test, so that it's the primary, the design of the current system really promotes first and foremost workforce participation rather than the education and care and long-term benefits for children. And so there's a problem there, and we need to make the eligibility much wider. So we've also already got an investment. The Grattan Institute has been doing some good modelling on how to widen the net and increase the number of children who would have access and the out-of-pocket expense to parents, and how to put kind of downward pressure on that. And they've done a number of models. We could see a more affordable system come through even using the existing structure, which, as I say, has problems with investing an additional around $5 or $6 billion a year. So that brings us to a total of around $14 billion. Or we could have a much, a completely universal system that requires an investment of an additional $14 billion. So we're kind of, the choice there is between a system that costs around $23 billion or $20 billion plus, or $14 billion or around the current kind of $8, $9 billion. So there's different ways you can think about it. But I think in the current context, it is critical as we're seeing social dislocation, increasing unemployment, increasing social distress. Investment in ECEC doesn't make good economic sense and good social sense for the reasons it has done for decades. But actually we're going to see increased inequality. And if there's one piece of public policy we know can ameliorate patterns of systemic inequality that's intergenerational, it is investment in ECEC. So there's every reason for government to be thinking about how to make high quality early childhood education and care more affordable with less of an impact on the household budget.
I think the word accessibility is an interesting one that we'll come back to. Associate Professor Elizabeth Hill is with you, as is Leah Rupiner, a sociologist from the University of Melbourne. But let's go to Anne, who's called from the Bellarine Peninsula. Anne, welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Hi, Rochelle. Thank you for taking my call. Well, I suppose I'm a bit of a case study in the interventions that can make a difference in women's lives. I was at a country high school in 1971, in year 12, and I fell pregnant. Now, a couple of years down the track, and I wanted to go into tertiary education, but fortunately, around about then, the Whitlam government came in, so we had free university places, but where was I to get my son cared for? Victorian Association of Day Nurseries was sort of means tested, but basically meant we just paid a couple of dollars a week. Now, that enabled me to get a tertiary education. I could get a career and I could go on and support my children.
And without that childcare, you wouldn't have that ability. And I mean, that's a really wonderful story to hear that, and you know, to be means tested like that and to have that work, it's incredible. And I'm so glad to hear your story. Thank you. This text from Adam. I'm 33 and I work in a low medium income job and just managed to support my wife and three children. I paid the mortgage on that income by way of many sacrifices. We have no support from family financially or in terms of care. It's all off our own bat. Like a previous caller said, we've decided to have these kids. We'll do what we need to support them as we go. It also would have been more expensive for us to have the children raised by someone else other than us in care. Adam, that's a really interesting point. It's wonderful that you've been able to make those sacrifices. I guess I keep coming back to that word accessibility was. And if you don't have an inadverted commas, a family unit, however your family unit is made up, if you're on your own, if you're in a dysfunctional family, if you're in a low socioeconomic situation, if you're unemployed, you want to try and get back into the workforce, there's all of these questions around what makes it possible and what makes it accessible, not only for the parent, but for the kid to have accessibility. Maybe it's going to be the only meal they get for that particular day for a period of their lives. It's going to give them access to early education, to friendships, to all sorts of things. So it's a really emotional conversation as well as an economic conversation. And those two never go well together, do they?
There's so much nuance here because so many people are looking at this through their own eyes and your own experience, and that's such a natural thing to do, but there are so many different ways to live. It's like when you first have the baby, you realise that there's so many different ways that people have done things throughout their lives, and everyone wants to give you advice and you don't know which way is the is the right way. It feels like trying to navigate through this, but then government has to make policies around this, and that's what we're discussing today. Should there be things like universal childcare for free childcare? Care is what we've been talking about, as a lot of people have talked out, that somebody has to pay. But should that be there? Let's go to Winchelsea now. Kerry is there on that number. Hello, Kerry.
I've listened to a few of the callers and I'm trying to see all the points of view. I understand where Peter was coming from. Then another caller said that he was archaic and sexist. But having been, I'm a woman, so I wouldn't call myself sexist. When my children were young, I put them into childcare part-time, and we paid for it, and I was happy to pay for it. And I don't think anyone who's calling up like Peter is trying to say that the kids shouldn't have access to childcare at whatever age suits, because all of the things you've talked about, like early interventions and women having a right to a career, that's all important. But where's the balance? Because the staff that are looking after these beautiful children of ours, they don't get paid very much. That's the point I'm trying to get to. As I don't think they're a highly paid, you know, their career is not highly paid yet. No. So maybe the money that everyone's talking about needing to get extra money putting to childcare could be considered to increase their wages as opposed to just putting more money in the pockets of people who are making choices to go and have a career and all those things. Everyone's allowed to do those things, but it is a choice. But those people are working there, and those people are having to fund and survive and provide for their families on a fairly low wage.
Yeah, I mean, we heard from Erin earlier, and that's part of the reason why she actually left the industry. She was sick and tired of fighting for higher wages. When you look at what they do, they're caring for people's children. You know, they have your children's best interests in their hands every day, day in, day out. But Kerry, do you think that, I mean, you've just thrown around some really great ideas. Do you think we're at a point in society now where the entire system does need to be rethought in some way, that it does need to, that it's a moment in time where it needs to change in some direction?
Yes, I agree. But each person is talking about a balance in one direction instead of looking at trying to balance three directions. It's not just about the children. Well, although, of course, it is about the children. It's not just about the parents, but they also have their rights need to be considered as well. But don't forget, it's about the workers. They are the third part of the equation that no one seems to be really considering. So the other two parts of the equation, well, the children don't want to miss out, but maybe the parents are going to be, maybe they're going to have to be prepared to find a better balance. It can't be free. It can be funded. And yes, you've got access to it, but it should be means tested. All of those things so that the staff are also looked after, because if we don't have good quality staff who want to work with our children, none of what they want is going to be possible anyway.
Kerry, thank you so much for your call. Kerry in Winchelsea speaking to us there. We're talking about, should childcare be free? Should the government be paying for it? Should it be something that stays as part of our society? It happens overseas. Should it be happening here?
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour
with Rochelle Hunt and Warwick Long.
Where today we're asking the question, could and should childcare be free permanently? Associate Professor Leah Rupiner is with you. She's from the University of Melbourne, and also Associate Professor Elizabeth Hill from the University of Sydney. But as that last caller just said, was a lot of this is about the workers, and we need to take their ideas, their wages, the expectations of the workers into consideration as well. So let's go to the industry. David Warland is the CEO of Early Learning Association of Australia. David, you've been listening to all of these wonderful comments and calls and the conversation that's happening at the moment. Where do you see this? Should childcare be free to all?
Look, thank you, Rochelle and Warwick, for sort of having this conversation. I think it's a really important discussion and long overdue for some good public debate. And I think, you know, what the free childcare arrangement over the recent months has shown us is that families that were previously unable to have their children attend due to either affordability issues or being excluded due to the work activity test were able to engage their children in early learning. And we know in Australia we've one of the lowest rates of investment in early childhood education and care in the world. And that means that, you know, 35 to 40% of parents' wages in the early years go towards childcare costs. So I think there's absolute logic in investing early and getting that stage of life right.
And how far should that investment go is really the question to make sure it goes right. And where should it go? Should it go to, you know, wages, as we were just hearing previous callers talk about, or should it be, you know, to make a universal system and then build from there?
Yeah, look, it's always intrigued me. I think I've been working in the sector for 5 or 6 years now, and I think prior to emerging into the sector, I'd sort of kept an eye on things and not quite understood arguments around early childhood. But it's interesting in Australia that we, you know, don't question as a society or at government the need to invest in primary, secondary or tertiary education. And I'm not suggesting for a moment that investment in those areas isn't important. It's critically important. But, you know, last year we spent nearly $90 billion on primary, secondary and tertiary education in Australia, and only $12 billion on early learning. And, you know, when you think about the fact that 90% of the brain development happens in that first 5 years, switching our investment priorities around a little bit might be helpful. But, you know, I think if I was sitting in front of the Prime Minister or, you know, Dan Tehan today, I'd absolutely be looking for at least 20 hours of free childcare in the first 5 years, with additional funding, you know, for the year before school to support school readiness for vulnerable and disadvantaged families or children with identified developmental delays. And I think the listener earlier was correct that, you know, we really do need to tackle the wages and conditions for our teachers and educators. They're playing such a fundamental role, and recognising that through better wages and conditions is really critical, I think.
This is obviously something that you've thought about and discussed, and you have a plan, an action plan that you could enact any time by the sounds of things. How overdue is this conversation, or how overdue is change?
Look, I think significantly overdue. And, you know, there was a lot of collaboration across the sector in recent weeks and months in response to the pandemic and the challenges facing our community, and looking at that as a catalyst for long-term change in our sector. And I'm hoping we haven't lost that opportunity with the move away from free childcare. But, you know, from my perspective, you know, the sector's very united around those ideas of, you know, funding those first 5 years and looking at opportunities to improve outcomes for vulnerable and disadvantaged children, because we know the evidence is there. If you get it right early, you know, you're improving outcomes long term. And, you know, the work of Professor James Heckman in the States has highlighted, you know, quality early childhood education and care can actually, you know, create a circuit breaker for poverty and create intergenerational change. So it sounds lofty, but the evidence is there to support it.
Can we bring Associate Professor Leah Rupiner back in here? Leah, you've been listening along to the David talking there and our callers beforehand. What do you think about the idea of even not, if there wasn't universal care funded, if it was just specifically for something like 20 hours a week or something like that, what would that do to the economy and to people's lives?
I think any step in this direction is a beneficial step in this direction. I think it is really important to 3 points that have kind of been raised through the conversation. One, we often think of caregivers as like just there to be with our children. They are educators. They're trained in the best early childhood education and care practices. They are enacting these things in that group setting. And so it's important to understand that, to pay them adequately because they're professionals. Two is that we often frame this as a question of choice. So a lot of what's coming through the discussion is, you know, I chose to have two children and then I chose to stay at home, but I chose to stay at home because we couldn't afford it. True choice, unadulterated choice, is when you could put your kid into care because it didn't cost you that much, or your family could afford it, but you chose to keep them home. When people are making decisions because they can't afford to do that, that is not a choice, that's a constraint. Right? And so we need to think about, how do we remove those constraints? And 20 hours might be the first step, but investment in high quality care that we know actually over the long term. I mean, this is so essential. Professor Hill is talking about this. We're hearing this all dimensions. The research is clear. Investing in the first 5 years has long-term consequences. It helps close the IQ gaps. It helps close the achievement gaps. It helps behavioral issues later on in life. It is essential. So how do we reduce the financial constraints so people and families can make legitimate choice about how to do it? 10 hours, 20 hours, whatever they need. But right now, we're not making choices. We're responding to systems that have barriers. So we're responding to cost, not choice.
Let's just get a last word from Professor Hill. Elizabeth, is 20 hours a good first step? Would you be happy to see that happen?
Anyone with any interest in ECEC would be thrilled to see that happen. But I just want to kind of join up, as Leah did, a few of the comments that have come through over the last 45 minutes, and that is that in this crisis period, economic crisis period, we actually, there is actually a moment to make an increasingly strong case for investment in ECEC. So many members of the public, and one of your previous callers is amongst them, have the misconception that investment in construction is going to produce a lot of jobs compared to investment in care, health, education, etc. That's actually wrong now. Like, we've had a significant change in the structure of our economy over the last, 40 or 50 years. We are now primarily a service sector economy. And some really excellent economic analysis and simulation that's been done shows that if you're interested in getting the most employment as a result of investment, public investment, then you should be moving away from construction, which is a very old-fashioned way of thinking about economic stimulus, and towards investment in care sector, health, education, etc. So the piece of economic analysis I'm referring to showed that the impact of investment in care industries on the total rate of employment would be twice that of the same investment in the construction sector. So that means you get a double bang for your buck if you invest in care rather than construction. And then the other really interesting thing in terms of the gender piece is that Australian women would gain well over half the new jobs that were created under a care sector investment scenario, but less than a third of those if the investment was in construction. And yesterday, the Australia Institute also did this kind of gendered analysis on the difference between the number of jobs for women if investment was in education compared to construction. But if we're just thinking about at the macroeconomic level of where do we get, what type of investment delivers the biggest employment boost for Australia at this moment, where this is a really key issue, it's actually investment in the care sector. And if we did that, we could have all these other things that we know are essential to the health, well-being and future cohesion and inclusion of our society. So this moment actually, strengthens the case if only our politicians would do the hard-nosed economic analysis and understand the opportunities they have in the current context to deliver all these economic and social outcomes through investment in care.
Can I say something too?
Yes.
If you give families back the money they are spending on their childcare, right, like what's happening now, they may finally have enough money to buy a home. And then you benefit construction. Win, win, win. Everyone's happy.
Perfect world, hey?
Yeah.
Associate Professor Elizabeth Hill from the University of Sydney, also the co-convener of the Australian Work and Family Policy Roundtable. It's been wonderful to get your thoughts today. Thank you so much for joining us on the Conversation Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Was lots of talk about this being an issue for women. I want to hear from a dad. Dan's called from Reservoir. Dan, welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Oh, hey, how you going?
Good, you're a stay-at-home dad. What do you think about all of this?
Yeah, well, I was. I'm not anymore. They're a bit older now, but I think there's a relation here between childcare and also looking at the parental leave, if you like, as a whole. In terms of, I think if we had more of a Scandinavian model, then it would be more okay for more men to stay home, basically. I mean, I think there's still, for many people, there's an assumption that if one parent's going to stay home, it's going to be mum. And I think it would really be helpful in a lot of ways, in many different ways, if that could shift to be either parent. And the government can help by altering the way they construct the parental leave schemes, if you know what I mean. Because I know some of the frustrations for women whose career has been put on hold, in some way. I mean, I've experienced that myself in the other way, I guess, because I've been at home with the kids, so I haven't maybe done what I could have done otherwise. But that's fine, because that was my choice. But it's that's because my wife is incredibly understanding, and she had her own career as well, and that's not always the case. So I guess it's the connection between that and childcare is that if there was more men available, or if it was more acceptable for men to be at home, then that would be another option for people, for families. I think the other thing that was confusing me a little bit with the talk about early childhood education is, I mean, both my kids went to like 3-year-old kinder and then 4-year-old kinder and stuff, and that's excellent. But at 6 months, my oldest child went to childcare for 2 days at 6 months, and that was childcare. You know, that wasn't so much education. So I think there's a difference in terms of the age that children start and what they're getting from an early childhood education or childcare.
And the level of that could change depending on the funding, I suppose. And these are the trade-offs that we're talking about today. On the text line, this one from Ian, Rochelle says, why not free childcare for household income up to $120,000, then prorata to $200,000, after which is 100% cost for childcare, says Ian. Wanting to put it on a sliding scale, there is kind of a sliding scale there now, and there's people that have been talking about problems with that. Also, a lot of people agreeing with Ian on the text line, wanting welfare for the rich is what a lot of people are saying, that should not be allowed.
Neisha Hutchinson is with us as well. She's the Vice President of the Australian Childcare Alliance. And Neisha, David Worland, who's from Early Learning Association of Australia, has been a part of our conversation today as well and wants to see something like 20 hours free or accessible to everyone. How do you feel about that? Is that a first big step forward, do you believe?
Look, we've always advocated for minimum access for all children, for 2 days a week, which is about that, 20 hours ish. Sorry, I'll get there. Which is, you know, for a long daycare session, and we still believe that that would be a fundamental pillar of a subsidy. So no matter where you are, rich or poor, or what service type you choose, there's that 2 days a week access for everybody. After that, then, we're looking at a subsidy that really focuses on vulnerable children and vulnerable families in the first instance and tapers off as household income rises.
How long has this been discussed from and in your industry? I mean, this is really the first time I've heard of the, we believe that 20 hours should be there and be available. And that would be life-changing. I know that would have changed my work-life balance dramatically in terms of me actually making some money when I went back to work part-time. How long have you guys been discussing this?
Look, we've as a sector, we've been discussing it for a long time, and international studies and now Australian studies are showing that this idea of two doses a day, which is, 20 hours, or it could be, if you're looking at a 9-to-3 preschool, as little as 12 hours, but that idea of two doses a week, and they look at that being for 40 weeks, in the year or two prior to school, is what children need to really make the most of early childhood education. And so we've been advocating for that for a while. Depending on what state you're in, it is somewhat accessible for that year before school. So Victoria and Queensland, for example, have got great kinder funding that's part federally funded, part state funded. Other states don't necessarily have that. So it's something that we want universally for all children all across Australia, no matter what state you're in, so that you can make the most of that. And like you said, if you've got this fundamental pillar of 2 days a week that's accessible for all families, then you as a family can say, okay, well, now making, you know, working part-time makes financial sense, which for a lot of people it just doesn't.
And I'm interested in your thoughts on this as we quickly come towards the end of our hour, but we have been through this period where there has been free childcare. It's coming to an end now. How much do you think the experience of the last few months and the government policy itself will change the debate in this way? And are you optimistic of progress?
We're always optimistic. You have to be when you're working in advocacy. Otherwise, you'd get jaded and get a little upset at the time it takes to make serious change. But we're optimistic that the data that we can collect from this, so, you know, the attendances from February through this period of free childcare, and now that we're going back into some kind of, you know, a scaled subsidy, is important. And the activity test has been relaxed a bit, which means this idea of a minimum number of hours that are heavily subsidised is more accessible than it has been in the past. And all of this data is what we really need. What happens to families, and particular vulnerable families, when we adjust the cost like this? Because the childcare system as it was built for a period of economic growth and not a period of recession like we're going into. And so it's important that it is readjusted to ensure that it's covering the majority of Australian families and young children, and in particular, as we keep saying, vulnerable families, get making sure that they've got the best start in life and an equitable start in life, so that we're not paying for them playing academic catch-up for the rest of their life.
And Nisha, just finally, I want to get a yes or no answer from all of our guests before we hit the news. And I want a yes or no answer to this text saying, after leaving Australia to live abroad with my wife in Finland, I realised how far behind we are in Australia. Socially, with parental leave, with childcare, parental leave is shared over 12 months by both parents, childcare, kindergarten, primary school, secondary school, TAFE, university is free, dental is government subsidised, 5 weeks annual leave, no sick days, we are so far behind. Are we?
We are, but you also need to look at how much people in the Netherlands are taxed. And that's when we've got a limited bucket of funds, you've got a lot of people arguing for that money. And if the bucket of funds was unlimited, this would be the priority for so many people.
And it always comes back to tax and who will pay. Rochelle, $23 billion is what we heard earlier would be the cost of a universal childcare system in Australia. And today we've heard the arguments of why that could be great for our society, and plenty of our listeners and other people have been testing it as well. And I suppose it's now over to the people who make our laws.
Absolutely. We pushed it to the nth degree today, saying, should it be free? What I found really interesting is that we came back to some kind of middle ground there today, but I think everybody decided that we are at a junction where some change needs to happen. Whether or not it does, time will tell. As always, Woz, thank you so much for today. It's been a wonderful program. People can subscribe.
They can subscribe to the podcast to listen back or share it with their friends. We'd love you to do that. You can also email us if you have some thoughts on this topic or any other topic and you'd like to sit down and make sure you've made your point firmly to us. Send us an email, conversationhour@abc.net.au. As we always say, Rochelle, we read them all.